And good evening. I wanted to explore a theme tonight that will give quite a bit of continuity with what we explored yesterday at the day long, which was entitled Practicing with Thoughts and Emotions, Including Difficult Ones. And we explored those themes in some depth, and I encouraged the continuation of that practice in the next week, and wanted to have a way to have the day-long yesterday be connected with what I talk about tonight and then what we explore in a week next Sunday. So I thought today to focus particularly on looking at reactivity in general. And I'll explain in a moment what I mean by that. And in particular, I want to talk tonight about 10 ways of transforming reactivity. And I'm using the word reactivity really as a translation of dukkha, which is usually translated as suffering. And most of you know that the teaching about the nature of dukkha and the transformation of dukkha, the coming to freedom from dukkha, is the subject of the central teaching of the historical Buddha, the Four Noble Truths. I think it can be confusing, though, when we look at the meaning of the Four Noble Truths, which is often expressed as the nature and cause of suffering, expressed in the first two Noble Truths, and then the nature and cause of freedom, expressed in the second two Noble Truths, I think it can be often confusing as to what we mean by suffering. In other words, what dukkha is and how we transform it, I think can be confused by translating dukkha as suffering. That is the customary translation that you'll hear almost all the time and that you'll see in the text. I prefer a translation of dukkha as reactivity, meaning the compulsive reaction to present experience. We could talk about it as a kind of resistance to present experience. And I think it can be a preferable translation for two reasons. One of them is that in English, the word suffering is often synonymous with pain. And the aim, I think, the deep aim of the practice is not to get rid of pain. That's actually not possible. But it is possible to get rid of the reactions to pain. And that distinction, you know, is expressed in probably my favorite teaching, the one that I give the most often, the teaching of the two arrows, I should say, which I give often here, I think. And how many of you are not so familiar with the teaching of the two arrows? So the teaching of the two arrows helps make a distinction between something like pain and something like suffering. Here's the teaching. The Buddha asks his practitioners, everyone experiences the unpleasant. How is a practitioner different from a non-practitioner? And he says, everyone experiences at times the unpleasant. And I'm going to call that pain. And he said, this is like being shot by an arrow. And this is the first arrow. It's the arrow of having unpleasant experiences. It could be unpleasant experiences in our body, could be unpleasant emotional experiences from interactions or from something that's happened, could be injustice, could be in some way something which we find unpleasant. Everyone has those experiences, some more than others. He said, in that, there's no distinction whatsoever between a practitioner and a non-practitioner. Everyone at times experiences being shot by the first arrow. where does the difference lie? The difference lies in how, in what happens when one's shot by the first arrow. A non-practitioner will tend, when the first arrow is shot, to shoot a second arrow as if that would help get rid of the first arrow. And so when I have the unpleasant present, or I have pain present, I may react by tensing in my body if there's physical pain, or blaming myself, or blaming someone else. If there is emotional pain, I may also judge or blame myself or others, engage in various activities, actions, ways of speaking that try to react outwardly because of the presence of the first arrow, the pain, the unpleasant. I may, when there's injustice, react, and I have received violence, I may be violent towards others. I have received negative energy coming towards me, I react with negative energy towards the other. Someone says something mean to me, I immediately react back and say something mean, and so forth. Buddha said that's like shooting the second arrow. And what the practitioner learns to do is to be with the first arrow and not shoot the second arrow. In other words, not to react because of the presence of the first arrow. That first arrow we could call pain, and the second arrow we could call suffering. So we make a kind of technical distinction between the two, which to me is crucial for understanding the teachings. Because when the Buddha speaks about getting rid of suffering, he clearly doesn't mean getting rid of the first arrow. That's part of life. The Buddha in his later life had headaches. He had a bad back when he was older. He didn't talk about getting rid of those. He talked about, presumably, he was pointing to the fact that one can have illness or pain and be relatively or completely non-reactive. So that's a very fundamental distinction that's crucial to our practice. We aim, in that sense, to not shoot the second arrow. We could say that's a distinction between pain and suffering. We could also say it's a distinction between pain and reactivity. I like reactivity a little bit better because it's, in ordinary English, pain and suffering are often used synonymously. And reactivity helps make that clearer. Another reason I think it's a good and even better translation is that with reactivity, we point towards two ways that we react. One is by pushing away the unpleasant, and the other is by grabbing hold of the pleasant. And those are two forms of reactivity. And using the word reactivity points to the way, which was certainly in the mind of the Buddha, that we can, as it were, suffer in two ways. We can suffer because we are reactive because we're not getting what we want, or we are getting what we don't want. Right? So that's a reason why reactivity can, for me, be a more skillful translation of dukkha. And so the working and transformation with reactivity is at the center of our practice. It's really one, I think, clearer way of talking about what the Four Noble Truths are all about. They're about transforming reactivity. And again, in the two forms that we're reactive. So 10 ways of transforming reactivity. Okay. Looks like that's about one every 2 or 3 minutes, so I'll have to... I may condense a little bit. So some of them I'll just mention in passing. But the first one is really a fundamental one. It's really being guided by the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And here we would look out for any kind of reactivity. We'd look out for any way that there is reactivity, and we would see in what way am I reacting. Am I grabbing hold of something or pushing away something? And can I let go of that reactivity, or let be that reactivity. And so if I'm wanting something very much and it's causing me suffering, I'm at a meeting, I'm wanting the agenda to go this way, I'm really wanting it, it's not going this way, it's going that way, and I'm starting to suffer, and I can ask, I'm reacting, is there something that I'm grasping onto or pushing away compulsively? And I can say, yes, I'm grabbing hold of this outcome of this meeting. Can I relax with the way it is while still going for my objectives, right? So again, letting go doesn't mean we give up our objectives, but we give up the grasping after the objectives. Big difference, right? And so, and then I can ask, what's going to help me let go? You know, maybe I have to reflect or say, you know, it's a long meeting and we, you know, we have another meeting next time, maybe it'll go better or whatever. So we reflect. And this is, in a way, putting into practice the Four Noble Truths. The first one is just being aware that something is unpleasant. The second is seeing if there is some kind of grasping or pushing away. The third is seeing if one can let go. And the fourth is asking what helps one to let go. It's really an application of the Four Noble Truths. So that's the first way of working with reactivity. And I wanted also to keep on connecting these 10 ways with the work with emotions and thoughts that we've worked with. You know, and I'm thinking particularly of difficult thoughts and emotions like being judgmental, maybe fear, anger, sadness, despair. These can all be connected with reactivity. So a second way that we transform reactivity, we spend a lot of time cultivating non-reactivity. Makes sense, right? So we cultivate mindfulness. So a major way to transform reactivity is to cultivate non-reactivity. We cultivate mindfulness. Mindfulness is non-reactive. That's why it's transformative. In other words, mindfulness of anger is not angry. Mindfulness of fear is not afraid. Mindfulness of the judgmental mind is not judgmental. So we cultivate mindfulness, we cultivate qualities like loving kindness, we cultivate wisdom, we cultivate the ethical guidelines. All of this helps us to be non-reactive. So the second way of transforming reactivity is to cultivate non-reactivity. A third way of cultivating reactivity, transforming reactivity. How many times will I say reactivity this evening? A third way of transforming reactivity is related to some of what we explored yesterday, particularly when we were exploring the nature of fear. And this is to realize that our difficult emotions and thoughts, like fear or anger or the judgmental mind, have within them often something that's insightful or skillful or beneficial, but it gets linked up with reactivity. So one way of saying this in terms of a third way of transforming reactivity is to realize that our reactivity gets mixed up often with insight or intelligence. It's what makes things confusing for us. If I'm angry at an injustice, and I'm actually correctly perceiving an injustice, but I get really reactive, it can be very confusing because surely I'm right. I perceive an injustice, but I'm reactive. You know, I'm kind of compulsive, out of control, blaming, judging, but I have right on my side. And it can be very confusing, so it's helpful to know that when we look at our reactivity, we often can find something that's insightful. Same thing with fear. Often we actually are really, in a valid way, afraid of something, but we can get very reactive, right? So we can, you know, it's skillful to be afraid of terrorism. It's unskillful to let that fear proliferate into overgeneralization and wild proliferation of off-the-wall theories. Right? But there is something to be afraid of. Right? And so remembering that can be helpful because we get hooked by the validity. Same thing, judgmental mind. I can notice my boss, let's say, acting in certain ways which are problematic, and I become judgmental, and I'm actually seeing something that's real, that's accurate, but I get reactive and judgmental, and I think because I'm seeing something real, you know, the reactivity is justified. And so knowing that reactivity gets often mixed up with insight, and that we actually ultimately, in the transformation of reactivity, have to separate out the insight from the reactivity, whether it's in being judgmental or being angry or being fearful. We want to, you know, like the mountain climber wants to respect the fear, but watch the proliferation that leads to getting confused and paralyzed, right? Makes that distinction. The latter are reactive, right? So that's an important one, to really recognize that reactivity gets mixed up with insight or with something valid. And we have to look for the insight and separate it from the reactivity. That can take time and effort. A fourth way that we transform reactivity is to study it intently. We have to become experts at our own reactivity. We have to know the top five, the top 10. We have to look at it over and over again. Study one's reactivity. We transform the reactivity in large part by having insight into it. That's why we call this insight practice. Traditionally, the core insights of insight meditation are having insights into impermanence, having insights into dukkha, thus into reactivity, by my translation, and into the nature of self. So we have to look at this over and over again. We have to have interest in reactivity. Know that the study of reactivity can lead us to having insight and into how things work, so we don't do things in the same way. We really have to look at this over and over again. Look at how the mind works, get familiar, know what the triggers are, know what leads to reactivity, know where I'm particularly susceptible to reactivity, have interest in reactivity. I like to say that when we have interest in our in the ways that we lose it, our practice accelerates. When I started meditation, I thought it would just be peace and bliss. I heard them talking about suffering, but I thought that was for other people. At a certain point, I saw that I too was suffering. What is sometimes called a blazing insight into the totally obvious. Much of spiritual practice is like that. And so, and then at a certain point I got really interested. And again, I think cultivate interest in how you lose it. There has to be a certain base level of confidence to do that, right? But have interest in the reactivity, in the stuck places. So number five, not doing too bad with timing. Number five. Is it five or six?
Five.
Okay. Number five, when we're reactive, we shoot the second arrow. Practice not shooting the second arrow. Be aware when you're shooting the second arrow or tending to shoot it, and develop the strong intention not to shoot it. So again, in practice, this translates into something difficult happened at work, I find myself complaining, being judgmental, all forms of shooting the second arrow. I notice that. I maybe have the intention not to go there. You know, more seriously, something really difficult happens to me, and let's say I go into a negative scenario about myself or about another or about this relationship or this job or whatever, and I notice myself shooting the second arrow, and I notice that, I notice the connection of that with suffering. I notice more how the repetition through shooting the second arrow of negative scenarios or very negative judgments about self or other just keep getting things worse or get deeper into the difficulty. So I say I will look out for the second arrow and try not to shoot it. Very fundamental. This is, you know, if we just had to take one of these, that would be a good one to take. You know, learn how not to shoot the second arrow. Number 6. Watch when we're reactive for the tendency of the mind to go wild with overgeneralization, forming narratives, particularly of the negative kind, about self or other, coming to conclusions, furthering beliefs which are far removed from the actual data. So when we're reactive, we will tend to go way beyond our actual experience and the actual data. In Buddhist framework, this is called papancha. Some of you know this term. It's usually translated as mental proliferation. And generally, when we're reactive or when we're having a difficult time or suffering in some way, the mind will tend to go into wild generalizations. Again, you can see it on the campaign trail, right? Difficult things happen. People are saying all sorts of things, right? Again, it's hard to know the dividing line between papancha and overgeneralization and actually deliberately being provocative. I don't know always what's going on. But we can notice in ourselves how we tend to go to this overgeneralization and to have our thinking just start proliferating way away from the actual experience. Right? We don't know really often. Have something difficult happen and, something difficult happens at work and we go to, my career is just not panning out. I should have done what my mother said and gone into accounting. Working on that would be a way of working in a sixth way. So we have to watch out for that. What that means, though, I was thinking, in an interactive context, people who are peacemakers often bring both sides down to the actual reality of a situation, because in conflicts, typically both sides get far removed from reality and get caught in narratives, ideologies, generalizations, blaming and judging, which again goes beyond the actual experience. So a peacemaker will just actually come back to the actual suffering of both sides. You know that line maybe from Thich Nhat Hanh, a peacemaker brings the suffering of one side to the other side, and from the other side to the first side. It's a way, really, of coming back to the more direct experience, because when we're reactive, we tend to go far away from direct experience. That's why our mindfulness practice is so important. And we can really study in our mindfulness practice when something difficult is happening, does the mind tend to go to over-interpretation, go way, far away from the direct experience, maybe one of, oh, I don't like this, or that was hard. And we start going into generalizations, in part because we're meaning-loving creatures. We like meaning, but it also can lead us to excess. And meaning which is not grounded in experience or reality or data. 7th way we transform reactivity is that we we learn to come back from being lost. To be reactive is typically to be on automatic and not mindful. We can be mindful sometimes of reactivity, but typically the reactivity itself is something we're lost in, we're not aware, we're stuck in a way. And so another way to transform reactivity is to have a repertoire of ways to get unstuck. I feel myself stuck in reactivity, what should I do? And we need a repertoire of ways. Some of them might be meditative. You know, yesterday we talked quite a bit about the heart practices like metta or compassion can sometimes take one out of reactivity. I'm judging myself a lot, I'm judging someone else. I can go to loving kindness or compassion. Sometimes I can go to empathy and have empathy for myself or another rather than being caught in the reactivity. You know, again, we talked yesterday quite a lot about ways if I'm really being reactive, sometimes something physical is very helpful. Take a walk, do some exercise. One's really, because reactivity, we haven't talked so much about it, but really is it also a way that the body gets into a kind of triggered place, an activated place. And often responding at the level of the body is a wonderful way to transform reactivity. You know, so something like the Qigong done regularly can really be a resource. You find yourself reactive, do some radiant body breath.
Right.
Seriously. And or something like this. I mentioned yesterday, I think, that I would go to these faculty meetings. I was once connected with a graduate school. We had 6-hour faculty meetings once a month. And sometimes reactivity occurred for myself and others, or both. And I would, you know, what I did almost, I was going to say religiously, after those meetings, I went right to the swimming pool and did a half an hour of swimming, vigorous swimming. And something got worked out of my system, right? So what to do when you feel, because the reactivity is sometimes in the body and it's hard to, you know, one's body's activated, right? It's hard to just say, let go, right? It's in the body, it's hard. So we need this repertoire of heart practices, body practices, maybe reflections, could be talking with a friend, listening to a Dharma talk, going to Marin Sangha on Sunday evening, one of the time-tested methods. Eighth, in kind of related, in reactivity, we lose our connection with our hearts. Again, we're lost and we're typically not in our hearts, and the reactivity is typically harsh towards ourselves or others. So deliberately coming back to the heart, it's really kind of very related to the last one. Coming back to the heart with these practices. Difficult interaction, find yourself reactive towards another people, blaming and judging. See what helps you come back from, you know, in terms of the heart. You know, for example, I take as a practice, if there's been a difficult interaction and I think I've acted somewhat unskillfully, these days I go almost automatically to forgiveness practice for a while. Even on the highway, someone does something, you know, aggressive, or cuts me off, or God forbid I do something unskillful on the road, you know, and go right to forgiveness practice. It has a cleansing power, right? The forgiveness practice, you know, because otherwise it can really, you know how these things happen. It just leads to the proliferation if we don't do something pretty quickly, right? Proliferation from some small way that reactivity was forming. Ninth way to transform reactivity. It's related to the way that with reactivity we're on automatic. And a ninth way is to work consciously with intention. The intention to be more conscious. And so intention can be very helpful. So we might have the intention, I'm going to a difficult meeting, and we have the intention, if I'm reactive, here's what I'm going to do. You know, or we know we're going into maybe a difficult interpersonal situation where there might well be friction. work with intention, have a plan to work with reactivity if it arises. You know, it improves, it doesn't guarantee anything, but it improves the odds. You know, that we might, you know, so I sometimes, if there's a difficult interaction, I sometimes go in with a strong intention to cultivate empathy, practice empathy in the moment, which means more or less taking the other person's perspective and going into that person's heart. And this can, again, be a kind of protection against going into reactivity. So working with intention, simply to remember this is a difficult circumstance, I might become reactive. That's another way. So the last one may be the biggest one. And I probably could talk for another half hour about the last one. The last one is that reactivity is ultimately driven by ignorance. And so we also need to continually practice and go more deeply to uncover and transform the hidden roots of reactivity. You know, and these can be personal, or these can be social, or these can be more universal. So I may take as part of my practice to inquire into some of my habit patterns. You know, maybe I'm easily provoked to being judgmental. You know, or certain things happen. Maybe when someone does something to me. When I was first in my own practice studying the judgmental mind a lot, and particularly in my own experience, I noticed that I had a pattern, which was that when I thought someone really didn't listen to me, I became very judgmental. And I didn't, you know, at first I didn't know that pattern. And as I saw it more and more, I saw that it was some kind of pattern. There was something there about not feeling seen, which may have gone back to my younger days, right? But we have a lot of, each of us have certain repetitive patterns which were inculcated early on, and they can be connected with our forms of reactivity. You know, it might be a sense of one wasn't seen, or one's needs were not met so well when one was young. And maybe as an adult, one's in relationship, and if someone doesn't give one the attention that one wants, one goes back to being 6 years old and not having one's needs met. It was very reactive, right? And so some of our work is doing this inner work, which gets into the root, the deeper roots of our reactivity, some of which follows follows old patterns for old forms of conditioning. You know, and they're going to be different for each of us. And really to see, to some of this means inquiring more deeply into our main forms of reactivity, seeing what they are. When I work with people on transforming the judgmental mind, we actually follow the trail of the judgments, and often for the most chronic, persistent, regular manifestations of judgmental mind, we typically trace them back to old patterns that were set in childhood. And actually following the judgmental mind gives us a way of actually getting at those patterns and transforming them. So some of our forms of reactivity, even if we're mindful of them, are going to keep on happening until we go to these deeper roots. So we have to go to these deeper roots. And of course, the other aspect of that is that we, you know, and this is touching base with the teachings of the Buddha, is that the deeper source of reactivity is a confusion about who we are in a deep way, related to the sense of thinking that we're more separate than we really are, of thinking that our happiness comes from getting what we want and not getting what we don't want, rather than in a deep peace of resting in our own being. And so our practice in this last dimension of transforming reactivity, this last way of transforming reactivity, is an invitation to go deeply into the various kinds of roots of reactivity, some of which are quite personal, some of which are social, We may have a particular social conditioning to, think that as a male, I should be in control. Anyone have that? It's also possible to have that as a female. But I may have conditioning, conventional gender conditioning, which in certain circumstances leads me to be reactive, right? Because I buy in to what I've been taught. And we can have that along all sorts of parameters, right? And so this last way of transforming reactivity, you can see why we could spend a lot of time with it. This is really having the deep curiosity to go into the roots of our reactivity. What this points to is that the deeper roots of reactivity are there in significant part because of ignorance. In some ways, we don't know ourselves. In some ways, we are reactive because of that ignorance. And so in that sense, it's hopeful, I think, because it's actually saying that the roots of reactivity, which are really the roots of suffering in the world, of violence, those roots are connected not so much on this understanding with evil, but with ignorance. We look out into the world, look at reactivity in the world, and as we know ourselves better, we can see that these are manifestations of ignorance, which is workable. So for me, it gives me a hopeful sense, actually, of looking, when I look out in the at the world, and we can see in many ways that the problem in so many circumstances can be understood using this simple model of reactivity. Conflicts are typically about two sides shooting the second arrow at each other. And for me, it's helpful to use what we've looked at. And I imagine we could take these 10 ways, which I have framed in terms of individual practice, we probably could frame them in terms of responding to social reactivity or to social suffering. I think we could. Maybe I should do that another time. That actually just occurred to me right at this moment. Yeah. So let me finish with that and invite you really to take of these 10, the ones that seem to resonate most with you. I probably should go through the 10 and just name them again, but I'm not sure I can do that. Maybe you can help me. So there was, the first one was working with a version of the Four Noble Truths, and saying, basically, if there's reactivity, where am I grasping, where am I pushing away, can I let go of that, right? And what helps me to do that? The second was cultivating forms of non-reactivity. The third was being aware that our reactivity often gets mixed up with our insight or our intelligence, and that we can sometimes make that distinction, and that can be very helpful, especially with emotions like anger or fear, or something like the judgmental mind. If you know, oh, there's some insight there, but there's a lot of reactivity, that what happened with my boss, I'm really judgmental, but I see something valid, but it gets caught up with reactivity. I want to keep the validity and get rid of the reactivity. So that's the third. The fourth was studying our forms of reactivity. Studying our forms of reactivity deeply. The fifth was learning not to shoot the second arrow so much. The sixth was watching for the tendencies when we're reactive for the mind to go wild, overgeneralize, engage in mental proliferation. The seventh was to find ways to come back from being lost in reactivity. Have a number of ways to do that. The eighth was to work with the heart practices to come back to the heart when we're reactive, because being reactive is to lose one's connection to the heart temporarily. The ninth was to work with intention carefully. And the tenth was to engage in this deeper inquiry into the more fundamental roots of reactivity. So I'll finish just with two quotes, one from a poet and one from the Buddha. The poet is Yeats. He says this: "It takes more courage to examine the dark corners of your own soul than it does for a soldier to fight on a battlefield." It takes more courage to examine the dark corners of your own soul than it does for a soldier to fight on a battlefield. And the last one is from the Buddha, really very simply pointing to what brings together these 10 ways of transforming reactivity, which, remember, I'm using as a translation of dukkha. So the Buddha says, "I have taught one thing and one thing only, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha." So focusing on reactivity can be a focus that's one's only focus, and it can take you very far. It could be your focus for the next year. I'm just going to focus on reactivity and transforming it, because it gets right to the heart of our practice. Thank you. We have some time if there are any reflections, questions, insights, comments. Please.
A friend of mine and I made up the term papanchoiding.
When you papanchoid
a lot, which I do. And the other thing, of course, I have to mention is metta and how much metta can help with the reactive mind, and to be more compassionate with oneself and with others, so that you said it all, that last one, the ignorance, and it seems to me like metta puts a light on it and really helps you to be able to understand where you're coming from before you react. And the more metta I do, the more I can see it, just like what you said. Amazing.
Yeah, thank you. And I think I probably can't say enough about the value of the heart practice and all this, because in a way, having interest in and transforming reactivity is going into places where we lose it, where we're not at our best, and so forth. And it can be hard to give a lot of attention to that. It's like that quote from Yeats, it's going into the dark corners of our soul to some extent. And so we have to hold this with a lot of care, compassion, metta, forgiveness, really is necessary. Again, when I work with people with judgmental mind, and I think because we've talked about that sometimes here, it's like the two fundamental tools are mindfulness and heart practices. And sometimes it's only the heart practices that one works with, just to keep that sense of balance and sense of connection with one's okayness, because we're giving, in looking into reactivity, we're looking into the hard places. So it's very important to be with beauty and with the kind heart as much as possible, if one takes this on. Yeah. A lot of hands, good.
I'm really glad you brought up the roots of reactivity, especially the really personal ones.
Yeah.
It's always seemed to me that that's sort of the Achilles heel of the Dhamma. It's like of the practice.
Yeah.
Because it's not part of the Dhamma. It does not, in my experience, it's not addressed in most teachings, and yet it seems like if the work isn't done in that area, a lot of things will stay stuck.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's one of the fruits of the current interaction of Western psychology and Buddhist practice is to make that clearer. I have found, for example, in working with the judgmental mind, I totally need to do that. You know, that some teachers would work with reactivity without going into the personal roots or not integrate that so well. And again, some things do get opened up, but my experience and finding both as a practitioner and as a teacher is that one needs to deliberately inquire into the personal conditioning and the social conditioning as well. You know, and if you don't look into the personal and social conditioning, there are areas, as it were, left in the shadows that will come up and bite one later. Or bite someone else, right? Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so I agree. And so how to do that's a challenge, yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah. So, because last year I've been working with not believing my own story.
Yeah.
And because I do have a very judgmental mind. And not only do I realize, I mean, I'd be right, I may not even know what's going on.
Yeah.
And it's been so much easier just, if I can catch that, to realize, you don't know. You don't know what's right. You don't even know, much less know what's right.
Yeah. So that can be very helpful, like the mantra, I don't know. Or as some people express it, I might be wrong. You can find the right, you know, rhythm and beat and so forth.
It's pretty neutral to say I don't know. I mean, it's...
That's right.
It's not a failure on my part, although yeah, at times I thought it was. To not know was really, as you were talking about the psychological roots,
right,
for me not knowing was a really... I was the one who was supposed to know.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's... you know, in Western traditions, not knowing is the opening to knowledge. You know, like with the Greeks, with Socrates, right? He said, you know, he went around finding, oh, all these people say they know. I know that they don't know, and I know that I don't know, and telling them that they don't know has made me very unpopular. But this is actually the beginning. This is the beginning of the Western traditions, which lead us to science and so forth. It's that knowing that one doesn't know and admitting it and having that not be a problem. And so, yeah, but the other side of what you're saying is to really track the proliferation. You know, that I think I know, but I actually don't know. Yeah.
It's very freeing not to know.
It's freeing and probably humbling also at a certain time, yeah.
Yeah. I find it, to me, it was just much more of a, I don't know. And it gets easier the more I see it.
It's great, yeah. Yeah. No, it's exciting just to go around talking to your friends like, I don't know.
I want to give a shout out to therapy because number 10 is really hard, is hard. And therapists help me tremendously in looking at the roots of some of my reactivity. So I just want to bow to anyone who's a therapist and encourage anyone who can to help. Therapy can help a lot with that. The one about proliferating mind is harder to catch because when your mind is proliferating and you're telling these wild tales, it's hard to realize you're stuck in one way. But a clue that I've discovered is the word never or always.
That's right.
When my mind is starting to say always or this never or I always or you never, I realize that's one of those stories that needs to be
That's right.
around. So I found that really helpful.
That's great, yeah. Yeah, to watch for these terms, which actually couldn't possibly be valid, but
never are.
They're always. Always.
Yeah. Saying never is never right. So, but that's great to look out for certain keywords like that, and to I think it can be helpful to do something like we did yesterday in the day long, which is to sometimes when maybe at the end of a sitting, deliberately bring a reactive tendency of mind, or maybe an experience you had which led you to be reactive, bring it to mind when you have basis of mindfulness, and then study it. Because if our reactivity and proliferation comes up during meditation, sometimes we can actually notice it, particularly if we have something long-standing that's there a lot. Maybe one more, and then we'll go to our meta cards. We may have time to come back for others.
Christophe, I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate your perspective and insight on this. Because yes. It's new to me, and it really is helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'm wondering if you have any examples of any forms of reactivity that are not traditionally negative.
I was saying that reactivity, as we were defining it, involves both grasping and pushing away. So are you meaning examples of the grasping?
I'm not even sure,
yeah.
Which is why I'm asking it, that sometimes people push things away,
yeah.
And as they're pushing them away, they are grasping or having magical thinking about other things that might happen that are keeping them from dealing with what's on their plate.
Forms of reactivity that are not negative. Well, if we could think of the grasping as reactivity that's inclined towards the positive, am I getting?
Yeah, I was thinking of someone I know who recently lost a job.
Yeah.
A big deal. And instead of processing the experience or even taking it in, she was talking about what her next enterprise is going to be, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to open up a dance studio. And that sounded sort of positive.
So the reactivity could, in this case, this person may have been pushing away the negative experience or the unpleasant experience, not dealing with it, not learning from it maybe, and just, we could say sometimes the person might be escapist, right? Is that sounds like what you're implying.
Maybe, yeah.
So that could happen quite easily, that reactivity could be, when we actually look at all the varieties, there are going to be a lot of subtle forms. Some of them will take the form of, I don't want to deal with this, I'm kind of reactive. Maybe there's in an interpersonal relationship, there's something that needs to be talked about, but I'm kind of reactive against going there, right? It's unpleasant, I don't want to go there, and so I go other places. And I don't deal with what actually needs to be dealt with. That sounds similar to what you're talking about. And then there would be a kind of reaction against dealing with the unpleasant that would be at the basis for someone just maybe, going to things which seem on the surface somewhat neutral, right, or happy or whatever. But there'd be a reactivity at the root of it. So I think that sounds like it's in the territory, what you're saying, yeah.